This is January 20th, 2008, and today I'm going to talk about detachment versus attachment. I got to thinking about this when I'm hearing all the scuttlebutt about the sinking stock market this past week. I gather it went down quite a bit, one blow after another, and it's all over the news. And I'm guessing that our own Sangha is not free of anxiety about all this. Maybe especially the older ones of us. So I thought I would just kind of wade into that and talk about it in terms of practice. I fished out an article I saved from last August. I found it in the International Herald Tribune when I was in flying back from Europe, by Garrison Keillor, called "Getting Worked Up Over a Down Market." I remember this last August. This was when it was still relatively high. I'll just read some of this and go from there. He says, "It's hard to photograph a falling stock market, so the stories about the big Dow Jones plunge showed solemn-faced traders on the floor of the New York Exchange or an electronic news banner in Times Square. The banner read, 'Stocks plummet amid cred,' while in the foreground, people crossed the street looking rather underfluffed." In other words, the story was illustrated with a picture of the story being reported. Like when your econ professor said, "This is very important," and you wrote in your notebook, "Important." It is news when the Dow drops 311 points because it strikes a deep gong in the hearts of older guys tending their retirement accounts. Who knows if 311 means anything at all? Traders often look solemn. Their feet hurt, and they drink too many martinis. But all over the United States, the 50-ish and 60-ish imagine our lives turning into a black and white documentary in which nattily dressed men stand in line at a soup kitchen. And then he sort of goes off on a bit of a tangent here. All right. I am of a generation of Americans that believes in disaster. The younger generation does not. A Harris Interactive poll of Generation Y's feelings about work shows 92% want a, quote, flexible work schedule. 96% want a job that, quote, requires creativity. And 97% want a job that, quote, allows me to have an impact on the world. All I can say is, wow, good luck. And now you know why we need illegal immigrants to do the inflexible, uncreative stuff that simply needs doing right now. We've raised a generation of young people who want to be writers. What's up? That's what's up, dude. In the workplace, the young sit studiously at their screens, observing videos of animals doing hilarious things on YouTube. Cats walk into glass doors and fall down. Horses in parades relax their bowels and let loose amazing quantities of flop. And meanwhile, the old guy in the office down the hall thinks maybe he should start saving tinfoil. He lives in dread of bad news. Northern grommets will close the plant and shift production to a factory in Guangdong province. and his position of executive assistant to the assistant vice president will turn to dust. No more free ballpoints for Bob. He sits and broods over his sad fate. Meanwhile, the young men and women in the cubicles are fascinated by the sex life of gerbils. After work, they go to mats and drink like the Russian cavalry and get totally blitzed and take a leak in the refrigerator. They are working at Northern Grommets only until Steven Spielberg calls and tells them he is wildly in love with their screenplay. This could happen next week or perhaps in the fall. They are almost 30, but their clocks don't tick yet. Their ship will come and they will buy a house in Pacific Palisades and be driven to the studio every day by Felipe while Maria cleans the house and Ramon does the yard and pool. I'm one of those old guys trying to maintain forward progress, sure that if I slow down, something will bite me from behind. I think about buying a new suit, and then the Dow drops, and I think, well, that's kind of spendy, isn't it? The old one is good enough. Shiny in the seat, but I'll just remember to keep my hands clasped behind my back. I woke up in New York the morning after the Dow fell, and there was a slight chill in the air, and it said, get to work, forget about stocks, be thankful for good health, go do your work. Don't retire. You would never get the hang of Tai Chi anyway. Keep shuffling along. My father was a carpenter and a postal worker. He admired people who came early and stuck with a job until it got done. People who embraced work. His republicanism was based solidly on that old bootstrap philosophy. Finish your coffee and get to work, and let's get this hole dug, and don't complain about the heat. It's the same heat for everybody. Stick with the job. Rest as you need to, then resume. The kids surfing and snazzing up their websites at work would be aliens to him, and he wouldn't have a lot of sympathy for the gloomy old guy with visions of disaster either. The people most like my dad are the Mexicans coming across the border to work hard and send money home to their families. He would understand those people completely. You know, through all of his comedy here, I think one of the things we can all relate to here is his just the work ethic. You know, this old saying, the world can be divided into two kinds of people, those who work for their money and those who have money work for them. I think for most people, to have money work for them requires working first. And that's, in something as complex as what I understand economics is, the economy. I hear these little things on NPR about everyone is utterly bewildered about what's happening next and the best way to take effective measures now. And there's no agreement, or often a lot of disagreement among economists. What control do we have over that? The thing that we certainly have some control over is applying ourselves to what we need to do. And this is just solid Zen ethic, doing what needs to be done. Zen Master Dogen had a few things to say about anxiety regarding having enough. In one of his talks, he said, each person naturally receives his allotted share in his life. He need not think of it. He need not search for it. The allotted portion is there. Even if you rush about in search of riches, what happens when death suddenly comes? Students should clear their minds of these non-essential things and concentrate on practicing the way. Well, he's addressing his monks, so that has to be said. And monks take vows of poverty in a lay sangha like this, like all sanghas practically in the Western world. It's different. Our members have responsibilities, not only to be able to care for themselves as much as they can when they retire, when they get older, but even more non-negotiable is their responsibility for children, their dependents, children below a certain age. And so I don't think anyone would suggest, I don't think Dogen himself would suggest, just give away all your money and let your children fend for themselves. But the larger point, I think, that he's making, and that we can all try to trust, is that there's something much bigger in our lives that determines our fortunes and our misfortunes than how much money we're able to squirrel away. This position is, would seem to many people, to the ordinary person, as just so unrealistic, so fanciful, that each person naturally receives his allotted share in his life. He need not think of it. He need not search for it. The allotted portion is there. And I think as lay people who do have financial responsibilities, the way we can interpret this is that we need, as practitioners of the Dharma, to cultivate detachment. Detachment for our own sake. It's either detachment or sleepless nights or sort of a constant low-grade level of anxiety about what's going to happen. The choice is ours very much. Of course, there are all kinds of things that can be done to manipulate whatever, to try to save more money or manipulate one's savings, such as they may be, to try to tinker with things in that obvious level of improving one's financial security. But then, when it is out of our hands, when something has already happened that can't be changed, well, this is where the greatest resource we can draw from is detachment. And detachment is not something we acquire by talking ourselves into it. Detachment is the result of serious spiritual practice, and usually long, serious practice. Because our tendency is to be attached to the outcome of things, to be attached to all of the dichotomies that tend to bind us in our lives. What are commonly called the eight winds. The eight winds are praise and blame, fame and disrepute. Those are four of them. They're four dichotomies: praise and blame, fame and disrepute, gain and loss, and pleasure and displeasure, sometimes desire and aversion. These are the big four winds that disturb the mind. This comes from ancient times, a couple thousand or more years ago. This is what human beings throughout time have had to struggle with, are these things that upset the mind. What is really the natural equilibrium of the mind, these things. So what do we do about them? Practice. Practice or being forever at the mercy of these shifting winds. Now, the stock market is just one of the most obvious kinds of variations and shifting winds. But really, the stock market is just one kind of circumstance, one set of circumstances. So, leaving aside the stock market, the health of those close to us, this is something we don't have absolute control over. There are a lot of things we can do to try to maintain good health, exercise, diet, meditation. But ultimately, we have to adapt to changes in health and in other circumstances. All of these complex things that have happened in the last few months with the mortgages and all that stuff. They're huge forces that are so beyond our control, and will never be within our control in any real sense. What do we do about those things? What do we do about death? Aside from our own death, what do we do about those close to us who die and dealing with those winds that can knock us off balance? The answer is detachment. Detachment is not indifference. Detachment is not disengagement. Detachment means seeing things in perspective. Seeing the big picture, the long view. In the Sharangama Sutra, one of the great Mahayana scriptures, we find this statement, swiftly flowing water viewed from afar appears still. If we can step back far enough mentally, we see things, we see the big picture, we see the things in their wholeness. And I know of only one way to do that, and that is through practice, either Zen practice or some other kind of practice. We have to balance. That's what gives us balance. It gives us it's a counterweight to our tendencies to get overly invested in the world of change, the world of fluctuation. One device that we can employ that I've recommended here from the seat in the past, but I'll just read some of it again, is to be able to stop yourself and consciously consider causation, the law of causation. I'm going to read from the founder of Zen, his words, or at least a text that's attributed to him. Where he urges students of the Dharma to consider some things when facing injustice or unfairness. These are two of the themes that most commonly, I think, run through people's minds when things go bad is, well, that's not fair. With my luck, here I am. I finally get in to the stock market, and then it goes south. Or life isn't fair. Well, here's what Bodhidharma would say about that. He says, suffering injustice. When those who search for the path encounter adversity, they should think to themselves, in countless ages gone by, I've turned from the essential to the trivial and wandered through all manner of existence, often angry without cause and guilty of numberless transgressions. Now, though I do no wrong, I'm punished by my past. Neither gods nor humans can foresee when a harmful deed will bear its fruit. I accept it with an open heart and without complaint of injustice. And then he says, the sutras say, he's going back even further, he lived in the 6th century, but he's going back to the time of the Buddha. When you meet with adversity, don't be upset, because it makes sense. Because it makes sense. The sense he's talking about is this immutable law of causation. This is a cornerstone of Buddhist thought, is that everything is cause and effect. That ultimately, there's no injustice. On another level, yes, of course, we know. There's all kinds of social injustice, economic injustice, but that's just half of the picture. That's looking at things from just the relative or the ordinary point of view. The other side of things is that ultimately there is no injustice, that everything is cause and effect. And this requires a faith to accept this. If something happens to a child, how can we possibly blame the child? Well, we can't. We can't blame that child. But believing in causation, karma in this case, there is some kind of context in which to understand it in some way. And he says, and by suffering injustice, you enter the path. In other words, by enduring, as we adults, by enduring the adversities that we encounter, we can reach understanding, because the misfortunes or the so-called injustice is a way of in enduring them without blame, without externalizing it, but just accepting it, then we are expiating karma that we ourselves have sown. Now, I hasten to say that he's not calling for passively resigning yourself to anything that happens that you could effect change in. Here's an example that comes to mind. Couple times a year, a car is broken into here at the center, either on the street or sometimes even in our own lot. And we don't say, oh, well, that's our karma. What can we do about that? Nothing. No, we try to do everything we can. We drill with the staff what to do when that happens. I guess it happened this fall during a sesshin when most of us were out at Chapin Mill. There was a break-in here during an evening sitting. And when that happens now, we just urge anyone to to just, if someone should get up and call 911. If you're pretty darn sure you hear a smashed window right in front of here, then that's probably it. So you act, you respond. But, okay, one's car has been broken into. Okay, why did that happen? Well, according to the law of causation, it's because there is something, some accounting that has to be balanced. So that can help one accept it. Certainly, if we see something unfolding in front of us where someone is being abused or some crime is happening, it would be a complete travesty to say, okay, well, what can be done about that? That's just that person's karma. No. In Zen, we always say that responsibility. What is our responsibility in any situation? What is our responsibility? It is to respond, to not withdraw, not disengage, not be passive, but respond. Doesn't mean you have to run into a knife wielding assailant and risk your life, but it means doing something, or possibly in some conceivable situations, it would be doing nothing. That's also a response, but it's a conscious, clear response to what's called for, and not just withdrawing. What Bodhidharma here is talking about is that which cannot be changed. This matter of karma, we always know what our karma is looking backward. We can always say, okay, that happened. It must be my karma. It's nothing. There are no accidents. The causation, that's just the effect of causes previously sown, causes and conditions coming together. Yesterday at the workshop, I offered this perspective that we spent the day here together, the workshop participants and I and the staff, because it must be because of causal affinity. Something brought us here. But as far as future causation, future things, that we can't know. Then a second one here by Bodhidharma. As mortals, we're ruled by conditions, not by ourselves. Mortals here can be taken as deluded, as less than perfectly enlightened. We're ruled by conditions, not by ourselves. All the suffering and joy we experience depend on conditions. If we should be blessed by some great reward, such as fame or fortune, it's the fruit of a seed planted by us in the past. When conditions change, it ends. Why delight in its existence? But while success and failure depend on conditions, the mind neither waxes nor wanes. Those who remain unmoved by the wind of joy silently are in accord with the path. But while success and failure depend on conditions, the mind neither waxes nor wanes. It's a saying that I've often quoted in Sesshin, that the price of gold rises and falls, but the nature of gold remains ever the same. These are the two sides of reality. Again, on the relative side, there is change. Success and failure, gain and loss, fortune and misfortune, the stock market going up, the stock market going down. The other side is that there is a constancy. That the only thing we can count on is change. That is the one permanent thing. But this isn't just a clever kind of word game. That means that if we can accept, become one with change, that's where we find our constancy. That's where we find that which is beyond change. And then we adapt. So long as we are attached to the way things will change for us, we're vulnerable. Here's one more from Bodhidharma. People of this world are deluded. They're always longing for something, always, in a word, seeking. But the wise wake up. They choose reason over custom, or you could say they choose principle over habit. They fix their minds on the sublime and let their bodies change with the season. All phenomena are empty. Calamity forever alternates with prosperity. To dwell in the three realms, that is, in this world, is to dwell in a burning house. To have a body is to suffer. Does anyone with a body know peace? Those who understand this detach themselves from all that exists and stop imagining or seeking anything. The sutras say, to seek is to suffer. To seek nothing is bliss. When you seek nothing, you're on the path. Well, I'm sure that this is all reasonable enough to everyone who's hearing this. You wouldn't be here if you didn't find it reasonable. The trick is to incorporate it, to be able to live it. Live this detachment. Rather than trying to sell yourself on it, rather than trying to pound it into your head, these truths, the way is to experientially realize them. Realize really means to make real. Anything that is just in your head, any principles or philosophy, as long as it's only principle and philosophy, is not real. To realize these truths means to confirm them through your own experience, which ultimately means enlightenment. But even short of enlightenment, there is so much further we can always move into detachment. And detachment is our freedom. There's a quite imaginative passage attributed to the Buddha that I think shows the perspective of someone with real detachment, someone with the big picture. He is supposed to have said, "I consider the positions of kings and rulers as that of dust motes. I observe treasures of gold and gems as so many bricks and pebbles. I look upon the finest silken robes as tattered rags. I see myriad worlds of the universe as small seeds of fruit, and the greatest lake in India as a drop of oil on my foot. I perceive the teachings of the world to be the illusion of magicians. I discern the highest conception of emancipation as a golden brocade in a dream, and view the holy path of the illuminated ones as flowers appearing in one's eyes. I see meditation as a pillar of a mountain, nirvana as a nightmare of daytime. I look upon the judgment of right and wrong as the serpentine dance of a dragon, and the rise and fall of beliefs as but traces left by the four seasons. How do we acquire this big picture vista, this long view? Well, it's not by fretting about daily changes in the stock market or anything else. It's by sitting. It's by sitting. Sitting reveals the insubstantiality of phenomena. Because we see our thoughts and our fantasies, all kinds of images and other thought forms, we see the stuff of the mind as being in constant flux. We see that it has no roots to it, that it is utter, perpetual change. And then we come to see that if that's the that's not only the nature of our thoughts, it's the nature of all phenomena, that we live in a world of flux where nothing is fixed and nothing is secure. On the face of it, it sounds like a bleak assessment of reality, but it need not be. There's nothing we can secure for ourselves because everything is in flux. Then, if we can make peace with that, if we can find detachment there, then we're home free. That is the way to become invulnerable, is to become completely one with our vulnerability, with our insecurity. This requires faith. Faith, again, in the changing nature of things and in something beyond that. Dogen, Zen Master Dogen, also said to us, those who would practice the Dharma must deeply, deeply feel the passing nature of things and have faith in karma. Faith that there's some underlying, imminent order to this world of constant change. Ultimately, it means it goes beyond even having trust in something. To have to remind oneself of the law of causation we're still not there all the way. But it really means not trusting in something so much as becoming trust. Through practice, we come into harmony. We become one with this mind of trust. Trust in things as they are. It's like the breath. We always have the breath. The breath will teach us everything if we can hear what it's teaching us, if we can read it. With the breath, it's not that we trust in the breath. We don't have to. We are the breath. It has a life of its own. When we go to sleep at night, we don't have to worry that we're going to stop breathing unless we control it. We keep controlling it. We let go. And that's trust. And we can do the same in practice. Beginners sometimes are run into problems of becoming too self-conscious about how they're breathing and trying to manipulate their breath. And even the mind can play this nasty trick where people can feel that their breath may stop. It's kind of an anxiety, of course, but kind of a panic. But we can see how irrational it is. And when we sleep at night, we sleep for 6 or 8 hours, and breath does fine without us manipulating it or controlling it in any way. That's what we can call that wisdom. That's the wisdom of life as it is. And that's what we have to trust in. And the same way, when we are suffering misfortune, adversity, is all right, what can we do about that? What can we change about ourselves? What can we do to prevent that from happening in the future? Of course, that's the part everyone gets. But then to have this other part, this detachment, where we can see it in this bigger way and just exhale. All right. What is, is. What has happened, has happened. Now what? Let's get on with this. In one sitting, to see the insubstantiality of these thoughts and all, is really, in a way, to see into the emptiness of them, that they have no fixed nature. And that is the way to freedom from the bondage of change, changing conditions and circumstances. To see into the emptiness of things. In the Prajnaparamita, we chant, "Dharmas here are empty." Dharmas just means things. It's an old Buddhist way of referring to phenomena. "Dharmas here are empty. All are the primal void. None are born or die, nor are they stained or pure, nor do they wax or wane." That's the other half of reality. We don't have to learn this. Zen practice is not, say, we have to memorize this. You know, when something terrible is happening to us, say, to go through that. Oh, that could help to do that chant in one's mind. "Dharmas here are empty, all are the primal void, none are born or die." But we don't have to rely, we don't have to stop there. It's through the daily sitting that we internalize these things. We come to see that the chants, these words, are not just a belief or an opinion. This is reality. The reality is just that, and we confirm it through our daily sitting and ultimately through awakening. So to access this mind of silence, of stillness, which is beyond change, this is the greatest possible way of securing equanimity, a mind of balance. There's an old Chinese proverb, "Even great winds are powerless to disturb the water of a deep well." We find our way into this deep well, this silence, this tranquility through the sitting. There's a story of another story I've told in Sesshin, but it applies here so well, about an Indian prince who goes into the royal jewelers, and he says, "I want you to make me a ring and engrave on this ring words that will steady me at times of fortune and misfortune." He said, "I'll be back in 3 days to pick up the ring." So he went off with his horseman, and then 3 days later he came back, and the jeweler presented him with the ring, and on the ring were these words, "It will pass." That's, again, the big picture. That's the long view. I've heard that people who just leave their stocks where they are, pretty much, and just decide they're not going to react to these spikes and dips in the market, do the best. Whether or not that's true, it's true in practice. That's for sure. If you don't react to the periods where things are going great for you in your zazen, and you don't react to the periods when you feel flat and ineffectual, but just keep going, this is what wins in the long run. It's just that steadfast consistency where one is not attached to the results of one's efforts. Well, we'll stop now and recite the four vows.